You are now listening to a podcast made in collaboration with the Copenhagen College Radio.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for tuning in to episode 47 of the Social Media and Politics Podcast, bringing you expert insights into how social media is changing the political game. I'm your host, Michael Pesetta, political scientist at the University of Copenhagen. Connect with us on Twitter at SMNP Podcast or visit our website, socialmediaandpolitics.org. All right, y'all. Thanks again for tuning in. I know I mentioned last episode that this would be about cyber attacks, but I'm going to hold off and release that next time because on Thursday, May 25th, the General Data Protection Regulation, or GDPR, comes into effect. And I think by now we've all seen platforms changing their terms and conditions or notifying us via email about these changes. And the question is, what does GDPR mean for political campaigns? That's exactly what we're going to be talking about in this episode with Brendan Tobin, who is the head of growth at eCanvasser, which is an organizing platform for political canvassing. So just a quick pretext, GDPR is a wide-sweeping regulation that's going in across the whole of Europe, and at its core has two functions. One is to give citizens and residents of the European Union better control over their personal data. And the second is to simplify the regulatory environment across the whole EU by putting in standards into place as to how companies, and in our case, political campaigns, deal with personal data. And so some of the key features of this regulation are that if an organization wants to acquire personal data from an individual, they have to ask for explicit consent. And then at any time, an individual can request what data an organization has on them and require that data to be transferred to a third party or deleted. So in a sense, giving more digital rights to European citizens. And then if an organization is found to be in non-compliance with this regulation, they will have to pay a fine of 4% of their annual global turnover or 20 million euros, whichever is higher. So this definitely raises the stakes for organizations to be more transparent with personal data and in terms of how they apply it. And that brings a lot of questions about what are political campaigns to do when so much of the campaigning in contemporary politics is data-driven and technology-intensive. So in this episode, Brendan and I, we discuss what GDPR is, what significance it has for campaigns, what are the democratic implications of GDPR, what does it mean for Europe versus other countries with less strict data privacy regulations. And lastly, we go into what this might mean for the upcoming 2019 European Parliament elections, where eCanvasser is working with the parliamentary group ALDE, the Alliance for Liberals and Democrats for Europe, and talk about what implications GDPR might have for Europe's largest democratic exercise. So without further ado, let me bring on Brendan. He is the head of growth at eCanvasser and joins us via Skype from Cork, Ireland. Brendan, thanks so much for taking the time out. Welcome to the Social Media and Politics Podcast.
Thanks, Michael. Pleasure to join you.
So before we dive into GDPR, why don't you go ahead and tell us a little bit about eCanvasser? What is the platform and what kind of clients have you worked with so far?
Sure. Thanks very much. So eCanvasser is one of these organizing platforms designed to help and assist politicians and political parties to organize the way in which they reach out to voters. So it kind of consists of two things. One is a voter CRM. So CRM standing for customer relationship management. So it kind of holds a database of information about those people. And then the other part of it would be these voter outreach tools. So things like email marketing system, canvassing apps, issue tracking, casework management, survey tools, that type of thing. So really what we're trying to do is make politics very accessible for anybody, because up until now, politics, there can be quite a high barrier to entry, you know, in terms of the costs involved in running for election. And what we're trying to do is reduce those costs down so that anybody can run for office and have very good quality professional tools for running their election campaigns.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, just looking at your website, those clients have come from all over the globe, from the US, Europe, and beyond. So do you notice a difference in how campaigning goes across these different regional and cultural contexts?
I think there's a huge variety in the way in which campaigns are run. Funnily enough, I suppose we get only a view of those that strata of political life that seem to be particularly obsessed with talking to voters face to face, because that's our target market and those are the people who we work with. But look, I think broadly speaking, the US market, US Canada is very much more developed in terms of technology and in terms of the structures and ways in which political campaigning is done. So anybody who runs for election in America will kind of know the system. Whereas outside of that market, certainly in Europe, it's much more, well, it's more pluralist, I think, broadly speaking, politically. There's bigger ranges of types of political parties, but also there's a huge variety in the way in which campaigning is done. So say, for example, in some place like Germany, it can be quite high level. Voter contact isn't done a huge amount. There's a lot of kind of skittishness around voter data protection. That's always been the tradition there. And so they tend to do like rallies and posters and TV spots, whereas in the UK and Ireland, you have that much more the American type way of outreach to voters and capturing information and working with relationship building. So there's a huge variety. We work in, you know, South America and Central America, and they're very much more focused then on mobile. So like some campaigns just run on WhatsApp groups, and you know, there's a huge variety. But you know, thankfully, it seems to be a very healthy kind of industry, you know, internationally, and that's a good thing. So we're very much focused on trying to help people, you know, improve the democratic process, I suppose.
Right. And the reason I wanted to ask about it is with this GDPR going into effect, it's kind of this wide sweeping legislation that's going in across all of Europe. And so before we get into, you know, what that means for political campaigns, can you give us a kind of crash course into what exactly is GDPR?
Sure. So general data protection regulation is something that has been handed down from European legislative bodies and now is being enacted by all of the countries within the EU 27, well, 28 still, I suppose, with the UK. And what it's doing is kind of amalgamating and gathering together all data protection legislation up until now. It's trying to empower citizens, and that includes voters, to have a greater control over the information that is stored and used on them by organizations. And those organizations could be companies, they could be charities, political parties, or whatever it might be. But what they're trying to do is bring to heel the way in which organizations store and use data about ordinary citizens. And I suppose things like the Cambridge Analytica scandal, which we saw recently, has really brought to the fore the dangers of, you know, all of this data swirling around in these big tech companies like Facebook and, you know, Google. And then what happens if that information is hacked or poached or by whatever means is taken from citizens? You know, I think what we have to remember is data is power. I know it's a cliche, but like really whoever holds the most complete sets of data holds a lot of power. And what Cambridge Analytica were doing was then using that power supposedly to influence large groups of people, in this case, to vote for particular political candidates. And so I think GDPR is good news for voters. It's good news for citizens.
Yeah, and I think it's important to keep in mind that this regulation is geared at businesses primarily, but political campaigns are also affected. So I wanted to ask, what types of data would be affected for political campaigns specifically? Like, what type of data are they using that GDPR would sort of have a relevance for?
So GDPR covers personally identifiable data. So if I held data on you, for example, Michael, and I had your full name and I had your address, that's personally identifiable data. It's data that identifies you specifically as a person. It's not going to be confused with any other Michael. So typically what political parties might hold about voters, certainly in the run-up to elections, would be things like name, address, email address, possibly social media information, and then these really sensitive personal data items that GDPR quantifies as things like voting history, political affiliation, things like that, which, you know, we're very blasé, unfortunately, about the amount of information that is out there about us. But when you look, it's not that crazy to think that, you know, individual countries can kind of collapse towards authoritarianism. And what happens if there's loads of information out there, you know, prescribing people's political affiliations? Is there potentially political persecution that could happen? So this is the context in which GDPR has arisen. But political parties, look, what I will say is this, and this is the thing, a lot of people go, oh, how could political parties hold this information about me? I never authorized that. Political parties need to hold some information about people, about voters, in order to represent them. That's the purpose. You know, it's in order to represent them rather than to influence them in the run-up to elections. So it's completely valid for them to hold it, but they have to hold it in a very transparent and, you know, credible manner. And I think that's where political parties are going to be facing a challenge over the next number of months.
Mm-hmm. And I noticed on your website, you have a sort of list or template for how campaigns can prepare for this regulation, because there's, you know, a fine that goes into place if you actually don't meet these requirements. And one of the things that you suggest is to centralize your data and data canvassing practices into a way that's GDPR compliant, which makes sense. But I wanted to ask about the democratic implications of that, because in academia, there's this kind of, you know, it's trending to talk about the platformization of politics, which is basically the growing power of platforms for political campaigns. So how do these regulations and aggregating your data and practices in a GDPR compliant way, what does that mean for the relationship between campaigns and citizens?
Well, I think it kind of has to be seen within the broader context of, like you say, this kind of increasing digitization of political practice. Now, it's kind of slow to the party in that this type of thing has happened in enterprise and in companies for many years, but their kind of politics is beginning to get to this. So is GDPR changing things radically? I don't think it is, but I think it's part of a broader trend towards, like you say, maybe platformization of politics. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? To some extent, I can certainly see the good in the future landscape of political practice, because for me, a political party that wants to be successful and wants to perpetuate itself from election cycle to election cycle kind of has to now do this voter contact. It has to reach out and build relationships in a grassroots manner, something that's kind of withered away over the last decade because tech has become, you know, like Google, Facebook, digital advertising has made it so easy for politics to operate without ever having to speak to voters. Now they're going to have to kind of go back to voters and knock on doors, talk to people in the community and say, are you willing to, you know, hear from us further and try and build these relationships almost like starting from the ground up. Now they're having to build out their grassroots networks. And I think that's a very current topic and theme within the political industry. So I can certainly see how there's a lot of value in political parties holding information in centralized, credible and transparent databases, because they haven't done up until now. It's been in the back seat of the car. It's been on the back of a cigarette box. You know, really important information that they might have taken down while talking to voters. That all has to stop. So that's good. And I think this legislation, along with kind of, like I say, the broader trend of digitization, kind of, you know, and it seems you wouldn't necessarily think it, but I think it will get people, our political parties rather, closer to voters in a funny way.
Mm-hmm. And what do you think that means for the effectiveness of these campaigns? In particular, I want to ask about, you know, how does GDPR, where does it put European parties in relation to, let's say, the United States, where there's less restrictive data privacy regulations, or perhaps in South America? So how do you see these rules about compliance and transparency in terms of the effectiveness of these campaigns?
You know, I think of it like this, right? So say, for example, there's 100 people in a room. And if you're in America and you're a politician and these 100 people are all of the people who can vote for you, you come in with a megaphone and you start talking to them and telling all 100 people about your campaign. And then the other door opens and another politician comes in with another megaphone and another politician, and it's a cacophony. Mm-hmm. And that's fine because it's a level playing field and everybody's got the same practice. Whereas in Europe now, you're going to have a situation where you walk in the door, there's no megaphones, and you have to go around and you have to network with everybody in the room. So it's the same thing, but it's been done in a very different way. So I think what you're going to see is Europe now leading the way in terms of, yes, voter data protection, which is great. And I think the US will become increasingly an outlier in the international community, because there's a lot of other countries want to follow suit with Europe on this. But it's just going to be a different style of campaigning. And so it's going to be about more about grassroots. I think a lot of the structures and, like you say, platformization is going to become more advanced in Europe than it might necessarily be in the US. And it's just they're different, you know, and maybe that's no bad thing.
Yeah. And it brings me to something I'm really curious about, which is and something that really stuck out for me in the congressional hearings, where you had representatives from Twitter and Facebook and Google testifying before U.S. Congress, where it was really clear that these legislators, and I think this applies in Europe as well, they don't really understand the technology behind these platforms and the digital marketing tactics that are being used in campaigns. So how can, because we mentioned a little bit this fine that can be put in place if you don't comply with these rules, how do you think the EU will actually enforce these policies moving forward?
Yeah, those hearings were hilarious. And I think what it brought home to me was that, when the senator is asking Mark Zuckerberg, so what information do you take from WhatsApp? And he's like, we take nothing. And he says, no, but what information do you take? And he's like, it's encrypted. We don't see it, you know, and he just wasn't getting it. And that for me was like, that's the general public. We don't have a clue. We don't really think about it too much. And we don't get the amount of information that is swirling out there. So that's first and foremost. And maybe that's on us that we need to, educate ourselves a bit better. But how is it going to be enforced? Okay. So the enforcement of this legislation is going to come down to the national data protection authority. So the data protection authority in each individual country will be the one that enforces it for anything that's happening in their jurisdiction, which is why in our country, Ireland, that data protection authority is particularly in the spotlight because guess who lives in Ireland? Facebook and Google and all these huge tech companies, and they're responsible for taking these guys on and controlling them. So, like, how is it going to happen? I think if you imagine, like, in the past, a data breach occurred. Say you're a political party and somebody leaves a laptop on a train and it's picked up by somebody else and they open it up and there's all this voter data in there. Classic data breach. You know, in the past, it was like, oh, okay, how did they let that happen? That's ridiculous. It's disgraceful. And we'll give them a slap on the wrist and there's huge reputational damage potentially. But, you know, that was kind of the extent of it. Whereas now it's going to be, if you haven't reported that data breach within 72 hours, you're going to be hauled up in front of the data protection authority and you're going to be hit with a potentially 20 million euro fine, which is, you know, that's an ender for most political parties. So I think fear will motivate people. I think it's pretty clear that companies are taking this really seriously. I think political parties are, again, a little bit slow to take it seriously because they might see some potential gray areas for themselves. But I think in general, what it's being described as legislation with teeth, and I think that's really what it is. I think the fines and the reputational damage together will lead to some very high profile cases. And I think that'll keep the broader political industry and business in check.
I want to pick up on this idea of the national representatives, these data. There's a certain name for them, right? Like data enforcers or?
No, it'd be data protection authority. It would be the kind of general term. In the UK, I think it's ICO. I'm not sure what the acronyms stand for. But they're the ones who are responsible for what's happening in their jurisdiction. Yeah.
And are they put into place by GDPR? Is that a requirement that wasn't there before?
No, they would have always been there. So data protection law is not new. It's been ongoing, but it's just not been, it hasn't been a unified piece of legislation. And to be honest, it's still not, because the GDPR legislation is enacted by legislation that, so each country will enact it in their own parliament. So here's our enacting of the GDPR legislation. And this is where it gets funny, because different countries will enact it in slightly different wording and different ways. So over here in Ireland, we're seeing the Parliament enacting it, but having a kind of a bit of a gray area or a fudge built into it around political processes. You know, maybe it's okay, we can hold on to voter data because we need it for the public interest. We can't represent these people without holding their data, you know, I think a lot of this legislation may be played out over the next 12, 24 months as, you know, litigation happens and people really challenge the letter of the law.
classic EU multi-governance structure.
Absolutely. We love federalism.
So I want to ask about these fines a bit and what they mean for campaigns, because as you mentioned, a $20 million fine could be just an ender for most campaigns. But does this benefit bigger parties in the sense that parties with higher resources, so your more classic center-left and center-right parties, they would probably have the resources to really, you know, make sure that their house is in order to avoid these fines, and they could probably absorb the shock. You know, the Conservative Party in the UK or the Labour Party in the UK, they could absorb a $20 million shock. But a kind of upstart grassroots party who might not have the resources to even be GDPR compliant, they might, you know, be the ones that are more susceptible to the risks, take the fine, and that would end their campaign. So do you think there's a kind of, I guess, imbalance in the realities of how this might play out for big versus small parties?
I don't know, because it would remain to be seen whether, say, you look at a small party versus a big party, the same data breach occurs, would the fine that is applied to them be based on the size of the party? That's possible, you know. Maybe the data protection authorities are kind of going to take cognizance of the fact that they don't want to be anti-democratic. And so that may be the way it plays out. Like, I wouldn't be overly worried about the smaller parties at a huge disadvantage. If they're breaking the law, if they're not being compliant with data protection, then, you know, you kind of have to accept the consequences. So the bigger parties, I wouldn't see that they'd be at a huge advantage in this. I think there's a huge disadvantage to them initially, in that they probably have a huge amount more data that they stand to lose in the immediate aftermath of GDPR. They'll probably have to burn a lot of data that smaller or newer parties may not have. So maybe, you know, I think over time, it'll probably even out, would be my guess.
Mm-hmm. And kind of on the flip side, it might even be, you know, more democratic in the sense that, you know, we've seen a lot of these political outsiders coming in from the Five Star Movement in Italy to, you know, Trump, Brexit, these type of really kind of impromptu campaigns. Maybe this will kind of stunt their ability to just pop in the last minute of election, because they're going to really need to get their house in order.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the landscape, like politics, we say it here all the time, politics is changing so quickly. And, you know, there's this theory kind of going around now about the start of political party, you know, like you're looking at En Marche, Macron's party in France, coming from nowhere and like decimating, you know, century-old political establishment in France, and to a certain extent, the Five Star Movement in Italy. And then you've got Novacenza in Poland kind of, you know, developing very quickly. So there's lots of parties that are kind of growing up and kind of developing very quickly. So the landscape is changing, and, you know, it's a really exciting time, I think, in politics at the moment, certainly in Europe.
Definitely. Can you imagine a way that a political party or campaign might cheat to get around these regulations somehow?
I think the one that I mentioned, let's just go back for one second. When you hold data about a person, or a citizen or a voter, you have to have a legal basis for holding that. So legal basis means a reason. And the question or the gray area tends to crop up when political parties interpret their legal basis for holding data as being in the public interest, and potentially other people looking at it from the outside saying, no, your legal basis needs to be consent. So if you want to hold data about a voter or a citizen, you need their consent to do it. They need to explicitly say, yeah, I'm happy for you to contact me on these issues from now on, and I can tell you to stop at any time. So I think that kind of is something that really needs to be teased out over the next number of months and see where that lands. Because if you're to read the letter of the law, that's not the way in which it should be. In other words, you shouldn't be interpreting as in the public interest as being your right to hold data. It should be consent, but it kind of, we're not really sure how that'll play out, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, because apart from that, and we mentioned this idea of data breaches earlier, one of the rules in GDPR is that you have to report if there's been a data breach within 72 hours. And, you know, I was thinking maybe one of the ways to cheat is to not report those data breaches, because we've seen in recent elections with Russian hacking and Iranian hacking that, you know, a malicious actor can get into a network and sort of just stay there for years and not actually make a move. So could that be...
Could they get around it that way?
Yeah, could they get around it that way? And are parties more basically required to bulk up their cybersecurity?
You know, I think about 90% of data breaches occur through human error, mainly through misplaced passwords or just sloppiness around passwords or passwords that are easy to guess. And it's very rare for like hackers to come in and break down the front door, you know, digitally. So I agree with you. It is possible for there to be like sleeper infiltration in organizations. The legislation does state that, you know, you have to report data breach within 72 hours of becoming aware of it. So I suppose there is potentially an option, you know, where they could cover up that they were aware of it at all. But I think generally speaking, that probably is unlikely. And I think, you know, in terms of bulking up their security, a lot of data protection security is really pretty simple stuff, like making sure everybody knows what they should be doing. So in other words, training and training again and consistent training. And when you think about political parties and how dispersed they are and how many volunteers and interns are involved and like casual staff, they've got a huge challenge there. And so that's what we're kind of telling political parties now is, yeah, it's great if you've got like your data protection officer and you've done a security audit and you've got a software system. But if you've got an intern who's got to walk off with a laptop that's, you know, logged into your database and forgets it on a bus, then you're going to be in trouble. So so a lot of it is human error. I think hopefully, you know, I'm kind of positive, you know, about these things. I think parties generally are very, they're not out to get anybody. And I think they will enact the spirit of the law. But I think where they might fall down is their ability to control what's actually happening in a very dispersed organization. But yeah, look, I have a positive attitude. These are, in our experience, very honest practitioners and just they're trying to do right by their organization. So I wouldn't expect there to be too much trouble.
Mm. Let's switch gears a bit. And I want to talk about what GDPR means for the upcoming 2019 European Parliament elections, which is this kind of massive democratic exercise across 27 countries, 28, depending how you interpret it. How do you think GDPR will play into these elections? Or do you think it's kind of not going to have much of an effect?
It's probably the election that would maybe have it might have the least effect on, because I suppose European parliamentary elections are a bit like the federal congressional elections in the US, in that there's about, I don't know what the numbers are exactly, but say it's around 600 or so people elected, and their constituencies are huge areas generally. It's the election where people don't knock on doors. They don't do voter contact. It's generally done through, you know, TV spots and posters and stuff like that. So I don't think they're going to hold a huge amount of voter data. It is possible that will change over the next 12 to 18 months. But my guess would be that the effect of GDPR on elections would be felt much more keenly on national and local level elections, where it's much more likely that you would have a voter database of, you know, 2,000 or 10,000 people, and that you'd be doing direct outreach to those people. So European elections maybe isn't going to be the critical one, but it remains to be seen. You know, a lot of the political groupings in Brussels are making a lot of shapes on this at the moment and gearing up for it. They're interested in using voter data, but I think they're a little bit overwhelmed by the volumes that would be looked at. Whereas in the States, you know, it's remarkable when you talk to a federal congressional campaign that would be similar. They're like talking, oh, yeah, we're importing 2 million voters and we're going to do outreach to 400,000 in the next month. And you're like, wow, the operations, the gears that they have to go through to get through that sort of voter contact is awesome. That doesn't really happen as much in Europe. So I think maybe not a huge effect on the Europeans, but like I say, it remains to be seen.
Right. And I think it's, you know, also sticking with this U.S. operations, I think it relates a lot to the first past the post system, where they're really targeting certain geographic constituencies, where these European Parliament elections are proportional representation. So there's not so much incentive to really target those key strategic areas you know, I think in the U.S., you're not trying to win the entire country. You're just trying to win those key areas, where in Europe, you're just appealing to a much broader base.
Absolutely, yeah. And the European elections, you know, sometimes they could just pass you by and you wouldn't even notice them, because it's a little bit, you know, it's a little bit different from a national election. It's not as personal. I think people don't get as involved in it as they do the national elections.
Right. But I was looking at the eCanvasser website and saw that you guys are involved, having a working with the Alliance for what is it? The Alliance for Liberals and Democrats for Europe, right?
Yeah, that's right. Ali Party. Yeah, no, like nobody knows these groupings really. But so the EPP, the SRPS, and ALDE would be the three biggest groupings. So they're kind of, each grouping has affiliate national parties. So ALDE would have a political party in every country that would be affiliated to them. And what ALDE do is they promote the ability of those national parties to kind of campaign, to do voter contact, to manage their databases, to run all aspects of their political campaigns. And in that way, kind of in a secondary benefit comes back to ALDE, because ultimately, if their sister party in every country is really strong, then the knock-on effect is that their overall operations are strong when it does come to European elections. So I know it's a little bit complicated, but those groupings, I suppose, almost work as if Europe was a federal state, and they kind of then do this, instead of direct campaigning with voters, they do indirect campaigning by helping their sister parties to campaign. I hope that's not too complicated.
No. And I think, I mean, of all these parliamentary groups, I think ALDE is one of the most digital savvy, with perhaps its main competitor being Europe for Freedom and Direct Democracy, EFDD, the sort of Eurosceptic wing, is quite good, piggybacking off of Nigel Farage. So what type of steps are you taking gearing up for the European Parliament elections? I mean, specifically within the context of GDPR. I mean, so first, what kind of work are you doing with them? And then kind of how are you preparing for this large scale exercise?
Yeah, so we were really impressed with ALDE from day one. They really had their head screwed on in terms of how they were approaching the medium term and the long term future. So they have this whole plan of action, and they send people around. We've seen nobody else do this. They send people all around Europe training individual parties and how to go and knock on doors. How do you do a canvassing script? What information are you getting? How do you do it in a secure way? Are you capturing e-signatures at the door for consent? You know, this sort of stuff. Like it's miles ahead of the other parties. And so we've kind of developed a partnership with them where they kind of provide our product to sister parties. And then so what we do is, we, like, a party might come in from Slovakia or from Denmark or from Germany, and then we onboard them and we deal with them directly, and we kind of help them in a kind of a software sense. And we have our team who kind of do training with the party administrators. So it's really, like, it's a very positive relationship. It gives us an opportunity to talk to people in parties that would be very difficult for us to reach otherwise, you know, in terms of the language barrier. And ALDE are very good at taking parties that may not necessarily have taught very much about their campaigning model, and regenerating it and looking at it again and saying, this is best practice. This is the way it's done in the US. This is the way we can do it in Europe, and, you know, kind of playing to their strengths. So for us, it's been like, it's been a wonderful partnership. And what it's doing is it's introducing us into countries. And once you kind of have a foothold in a country, then you can start talking to other parties. And so there's a great opportunity for us to grow as the primary provider in Europe, because realistically, all political technology is developed in the US. We're one of the few that kind of have developed outside of that. And it's nice for those European parties to, because traditionally when they have interfaced with technology, it's been an American model and it hasn't always fit exactly the way they operate. So we've got a bit more flexibility built into our system, and therefore, you know, we can make it work in Croatia, or we can make it work in the Netherlands, or whatever they want to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's super interesting, the whole different structures, and definitely nice to get a bit wonky on European politics. Don't get to do that every day. But Brendan, thanks so much for taking the time out. This has been super insightful.
Real pleasure.
I've just been speaking with Brendan Tobin, head of growth at eCanvasser. You can check out their work at eCanvasser.com. And that's a wrap for this episode of the Social Media and Politics podcast. Thank you again for tuning in. Next time, I promise we will get around to cyber attacks on social media. And I've got a bunch of cool interviews lined up for when I go to DC next month. So if you want to get a sneak peek as to who I'll be interviewing and even ask them some questions that might be relevant to your organization, you can sign up for the Social Media and Politics newsletter, which you'll find on the website or in the show notes of this episode. I'm your host, Michael Becetta, signing off from Chapel Hill. See you next time.